Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Hello, what is good, everybody? Welcome in. It is a new edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by BetDSI.com. Ben Heisler with you for now, but in just a few minutes, you will hear from the longtime ESPN play-by-play broadcaster, the voice of Big Monday on the worldwide leader, Bob Wischusen. He's also been the longtime play-by-play radio voice of the New York Jets, and you'll hear him occasionally filling in for guys like Stephen A. Smith on ESPN Radio, also locally on ESPN Radio in New York. Great storyteller, and we covered everything from life and places on the road to nuances of good play-by-play, the juxtaposition of working with Dick Vitale and Fran Fraschilla and Brock Heward, even talked about his first Phish concert, which if you're like us, the first show is always a memorable story, but so much more. Like so many of our guests, he was gracious with his time as we caught up just before the big Monday game between Iowa State and Kansas. But before we get to Bob, a reminder that the Awful Announcing Podcast is presented by BetDSI, and with the Super Bowl less than 2 weeks away, this is definitely where I will be playing everything on the wagering side. They have betting options for NFL, NBA, college, hockey, UFC, golf, politics, reality TV, those are all part of the site as well. They are the top-rated site on all the betting review sites with a super easy interface. Don't forget to check out their mobile site in case you are away from your laptop or your tablet. Also, if you're doing a little bit of live betting too, which if you have played on BetDSI or if you've played on several of these places before, that is so much fun to be able to be a part of. And they already have a ton of prop bets out ahead of the big game in Atlanta. Some really fun prop bets too that I might add. Like, will any players do the floss dance after scoring a touchdown? I have to double check on what those odds are. For Awful Announcing Podcast listeners, you guys get a 100% bonus match when you go to BetDSI.com. Use the promo code AWFUL100, AWFUL100. So you go, you deposit maybe $100, $200, they'll match that entirely. And ahead of the Super Bowl, it's a great time to jump in. Again, promo code AWFUL100 at BetDSI.com. Remember, it is only a game until you bet it at BetDSI. Bob Wischusen of ESPN is coming up next. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Do you guys ever get a chance, like if you know that there's one place in Morgantown, for example, that you want to make sure that you get a chance to check out, do you try and make it a point to like get the production crew and get everybody out there, or is it basically say, I'll show up and wherever you want to go, we'll go?
Yeah, like honestly, I mean, most of the places, Lawrence actually is pretty cool. It's got like Massachusetts Street where there's a bunch of different restaurants and whatnot. I mean, yeah. We're going to Cheddar's sometimes, or where some of the places, you know, like, it's not, not a lot of gourmet spots to go visit. So, I mean, we'll put the word out to the crew. Hey, who's getting in? And then everybody will try and scramble together and go at least have dinner the night before. But like a day like today, I mean, it's a work day basically all the way through. You know, everybody is, you know, the crew is usually called to the building for an 8 o'clock start by noon or 11 a.m. And then, I mean, they are here from then all the way through the end of the game. So tonight we'll be drive to the Kansas City airport and grab a beer and go to bed and then get up at, you know, crack of dawn and be flying out tomorrow morning. And that's just kind of the routine.
So it's usually three games a week for you guys?
I do 90% of the time I do two.
Okay.
I'll do a Saturday game somewhere and a Monday game somewhere. And be home, you know, like get home on Tuesday, be home Wednesday, Thursday, leave again Friday.
Got it.
Do a game Saturday, go somewhere Sunday. That's kind of the cycle. But college basketball, there is such a ridiculous amount of inventory. And the games so often based on, who knows, people get trapped because of travel or a team is a lot better than you ever thought they were going to be. Like last year when Trae Young exploded on the scene. All of a sudden, all of these games that we had for Oklahoma that were like going to be, you know, ESPNU or ESPN3, they're like, we have to put this kid on TV every chance we have. And now I'm getting calls saying, hey, you know, I know you're doing the Kansas game on Monday, but, you know, Oklahoma's playing Baylor on Tuesday. We need you to go down there. And, you know, so sometimes some unforeseen circumstances all of a sudden will have you adding a third game. But it's not like working for a team where you're on their charter.
Right.
Or working NBA where it's nothing but major cities with huge airports with a lot of flights and nonstop flights. I mean, you're doing college sports. You are trying to get to some hard places to get to sometimes. And you are flying on little regional jets with connections. And, I mean, it's hard sometimes to travel either day of game and be sure you're going to get there.
For sure.
You know, or have, you know, more than two games built into a week just because sometimes it takes a long time to get to some of these places. So that's kind of the challenge of it. You know, college sports is different in a way that people probably wouldn't understand from pro sports where, you know, when I'm working with the Jets or when I used to work with the Knicks and Rangers, I mean, 2 hours after the game's over, I'm on their airplane flying home. Like, I don't have to deal with an airport. I don't have to deal with, you know, hotel stays. I mean, you're on a charter. You're just going home. So you could do five games in a week if you're traveling like that.
Oh, that's true. But then again, it's still you're still doing five games in a week, and I think a lot of people that are listening would probably think that initially, oh, yeah, that'd be easy to prepare for. No, man, it's not. Like, so much of the preparation I find fascinating, too, and sort of how everybody puts it together. But I can't imagine calling five games over the course of the week. And the guys that do the, you know, the NCAA tournament games or when you guys are doing conference championship games and conference tournament games, that's insane.
Yeah, the one thing I would say, though, is, and you're right, because you're on the air a lot longer, but the one thing I would say is college football trains you from a preparatory standpoint to be ready for any of that. Because college football is a beast unto itself. I mean, you've got two teams that both have 80 guys on their team that are on scholarship. 50 to 60 of those guys could conceivably get in the game. And you're starting over oftentimes with
right.
prep every week. So really, like, getting ready for one college football game is probably almost as much, if not as much work, as getting ready for eight college basketball teams at, like, an NCAA tournament setting. Because a college basketball team's going to have a dozen guys. And they're probably going to have anywhere from a 7 to 9 man rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And even out of that 7 to 9 man rotation, there's only 3 or 4 of those guys that are going to be, you know, primary players, that are the guys that are going to score the points, that are going to be dunking, that are going to be making plays. I mean, it's eight college basketball teams would kind of equate to one college football game in that regard. So as long as you can do college football, I could do 5 basketball games in a heartbeat in a week because I've done so much college football and have kind of fallen into that preparatory groove of getting ready for one of those games. The one thing I would say, and I really believe this about people in our business, of all of the different sports that there are, because I've done them all. I mean, I've done television or radio for the NHL, Major League Baseball, pro football, college basketball, pro basketball. I mean, you know, I've done all of them. So I've prepared for all of them. Nothing is like college football. If you haven't prepared for a college football game, then you haven't done, like, the master class in preparing. Preparing for an NFL game is half the work. It's probably a third of the work because everyone knows who the players are. But I could do a pro football game tomorrow with probably almost any two teams in the NFL without even doing much preparation just because there's only 32 teams. We all watch them all the time.
Right.
All of the players are kind of household names. Year by year by year, a lot of the primary players on these teams stay on these teams. So it's not like there's new faces. So it's 30% of the work is getting ready for college football. In college football, if I had a team last year, there's a very good chance that their 10 best players and all of the stories that I have logged from last season and all of the prep that I did last season is all out the window because it's all new guys. Like, if
right.
I had Clemson last year, I didn't have any of those guys.
Right.
Mike Williams is gone. Kelly Bryant's gone. Now, all of a sudden, I'm starting over with a freshman quarterback and ETN at running back. And, you know, like, you've got a completely new cast of characters for the best team in the game. So, like, you know, long story long, college football is a completely different entity unto itself. And if you can prepare for a college football game, then you can prepare for anything else that anyone in your business throws at you.
From a technical side, would you say that, as far as actually calling a game, would you consider it to be hockey as the most difficult? Because I've heard it from both sides of the spectrum that hockey, you have to be on top of everything and you have to know exactly where it is and you can't fall behind, versus some broadcasters love hockey because they know that everything that they're saying is about the action directly in front of them, as opposed to talking about the storylines of the game and about the teams. Like, you can just actually focus primarily on play-by-play.
Yeah, it's hard to tell a story, a human interest story, while the puck is in action. I mean, because you could blink your eyes and someone could go from behind their own net to the other team's blue line, fire a shot, and score. So I love hockey. I mean, I grew up as a huge hockey fan. It's probably the thing I miss the most since coming to ESPN. I haven't been able to call a hockey game since I left Madison Square Garden. So I do miss it a lot, but it definitely is a game of rhythm. The guys that are able to call it and call it well and make it look easy to call are the ones that just get into that flow of knowing exactly the rhythm of how fast the puck moves and how fast the game moves. And I'm sure for me, it would take me a little while to get back into that rhythm of calling it. I do think, because it is kind of name soup, I mean, there's just so many guys, it's the guys hopping over the boards, and all of a sudden you look to your left, some guys behind the net with the puck, you look to your right, and four new teammates could be flying down the ice to join him that weren't out there when he went, when your line of vision left the bench, four guys could hop over the boards. So you have to constantly be on your toes and refocusing to make sure that you're on top of who's out there. But I'll tell you, I actually think something that's equally difficult is baseball. And not for the reason that most people think. Most people think, when I say how hard I think baseball is, they think it's because of the filler. There's all that downtime. And that's, telling baseball stories is fun. Talking right to your broadcast partner about the game is fun. There's a million things. I used to do talk shows for 4 hours by myself when I didn't even have a game to call. So filling the time is not the issue. To me, the thing that's the hardest about baseball, and I think it is what makes it unique to every other sport, is the complete unpredictability of it compared to the other sports. Like all the other sports, there's at least some anticipatory advantage you have, especially if you've called a lot of games, where you kind of know what's coming. Mm-hmm. If it's 3rd and 10, and Tom Brady's in the shotgun, and he's got two receivers on either side of the field, there's a pretty good chance he's throwing the ball. And there's really only one of three or four guys that he's going to throw it to. So you can kind of anticipate the names that are going to be involved in your call, what they're going to run. If you're calling a basketball game, and, LeBron has the ball at the top of the key, or James Harden's got the ball at the top of the key with 5 seconds on the shot clock, shot's going up.
Right.
Like, it's going up, and you can kind of anticipate what's going to happen. Baseball, the ball is traveling 98 miles an hour. It is 6 inches from a hitter's bat, and you have no idea what's going to happen. You have no idea where it's going. All hell could break loose at any moment. And to me, I'll give you a good example. I was working with a guy who had not done a ton of play-by-play on a baseball game. This has got to be 20 years ago. And it was a radio game. And teams got runners on first and second, and the batter lines a ball down the right field line, and the standard call should be a double. Guy from second scores easily. Guy from first might even come around and score. It's either a one RBI or two RBI double, or there's runners on second and third. Just kind of your standard call. And the relay comes in so quickly that the guy who was on first runs through a stop sign at third base. So the third baseman is giving the guy the stop sign. He runs through it, and about halfway to home plate, all of a sudden then puts the brakes on, because he takes a peek to his left and is like, oh, no, I'm in trouble here.
Right.
The guy who hit the double, he's got his eyes, of course, on the lead runner. He sees him break to the plate. He rounds second because he's going to go to third, because now the throw's going to come home because the guy from first is trying to score. Now he puts the brakes on because the guy in between – third base and home puts the brakes on. The catcher now has the ball, and he is running in between the pitcher's mound and the third baseline, and he's got two guys caught in a double rundown. Now, call that on radio. If you haven't called a ton of baseball games, then sequentially how you call all of that and the total unpredictable nature of how hard that play is to call, like the guys that are really good at it are going to make that seem way easier than it is. And the guy that I was working with had not done a lot of games and was still kind of, you know, getting his play-by-play chops. And if you were listening on the radio, you would have had no idea any of that was happening. Because the poor guy, it was this really difficult sequence to call. And, of course, I'm sitting next to him, and there's kind of a car accident happening to your right, and you're thinking, oh, my God, if there's anything I could do to bail him out, but it's his call. And at the same time, I'm thinking, and thank God that wasn't my call, because I haven't done a lot of baseball games, and I'm honestly, I don't know how well I would have handled it either. So, you know, again, long story long, I think baseball has an unpredictable nature to it, where really there are things that you've never seen happen from game to game to game, that unless you've called a million innings and you're just so comfortable in your own skin that you feel like you can handle anything, that you can really be thrown off guard calling baseball, because there's so many nuances to the game and rules, and all of a sudden there's a balk called and you don't know why, and there's a lot of things that can happen in baseball that can take you by surprise.
Do you remember when you first finally felt comfortable as a broadcaster? And a lot of times when I talk to different guys that are either longtime play-by-play broadcasters or talk show hosts, for so long it's about who they spent growing up listening to, and initially that was part of their style because they liked how it sounded, until eventually something just sort of comes on and they're comfortable enough to sound like themselves. So who was that guy for you maybe early on that you spent grow up in New Jersey listening to, and then when did you feel like you finally sort of figured out your own voice?
Well, I mean, in our area, we've got 9 pro sports teams, you know, so it's not like if you grow up in Kansas City and you're a baseball fan, the only voice you're listening to is the voice of the Royals. You know, when I think back to growing up, I had radio and television voices to listen to of 9 different pro sports teams. So that's 18 different potential broadcasters I'm listening to. And of course, you're talking anywhere from like a Marv Albert to a Bob Murphy to a Phil Rizzuto to, I mean, look, you want to talk about running the gamut. I mean, you know, all different kinds of styles and all different kinds of famous voices. So I've always looked at it just in my silo of, I just want to call the game. The guys I always listened to that I respected, and hopefully that's the guy that people think I am, is I'm there to compliment the game, not be any part of the story, and just to call the game. And hopefully I'm mostly talking to you on the air the same way I'd be talking to you if I was, you know, in one recliner and you were in the next one and the game was on television. You know, I never really tried to develop like a signature call, or I never really tried to develop a catchphrase, or, I mean, I don't know. To me, it's always just been about just call the game. And I'm also not too blind to realize that no one is watching the game for me. They're watching the game for the game, and hopefully I'm just part of their experience in watching it that accents it and adds a little enjoyment to it. But understanding that if I weren't calling it and someone else were calling it, the viewer would still be watching it, or the listener would still be listening to it, because it's the game, it's not me. So that's always the way I've approached it. So I guess early on in my career, I kind of felt like I found my own voice, because I never really tried to put anybody else's voice on it, because the guys that I always found I really enjoyed listening to were the guys that I felt didn't try to put some big, you know, personal, you know, persona, you know, as the overlay of the game. They just called the game. And so, over the years, I've really come to respect a lot of the guys. You know, I'm probably a much, you know, easier critic than most, because I know how hard the job is to do. So the guys that make it look easy to do, I think, you know, deserve my respect, because I know how hard it is for them to make it look that easy. So, you know, the wealth of talent that I've either come across at ESPN, or in New York, you know, the Marvs, the Ian Eagles, the Sam Rosens, the the Howie Roses. I mean, there's so many really talented guys. And then, you know, you're at ESPN. One of the first years I was at ESPN, I remember being at the college football seminar, and we did a play-by-play breakout session. And I'm like 32 years old, and I'm in a room with Brent Musburger and Mike Patrick and Brad Nessler and Sean McDonough, and I'm like, what am I doing in this room? And so I just sat there and just listened to the BS, you know what I mean? Like, they would tell their stories, and they would talk about how they prepared, and, you know, I didn't say a word. I just sat back, and it was like a two-hour masterclass in how to prep and what's important and how to communicate with your producer and how to know what to ask for and hopefully, you know, good interactions with your analysts, how to get the best out of them. And, you know, that to me, that's always a blessing when you have a chance to, you know, to kind of rub elbows with guys like that, that I was probably in a room that collectively had about 300 years of play-by-play experience in it, and I'm 32 at the time. So that was, hopefully there have been a couple times where I've been in that room and I've had something to say, where there was a 32-year-old in the room that was saying, wow, you know, this guy knows what he's talking about. Well, yeah, I mean, that also comes from some of that knowledge being passed down by others.
Well, so much of that too, Bob, is feedback. And one of my biggest frustrations when I was working in radio was the lack of feedback from peers, from others in the business. Like, you really had to go out of your way to get people to listen to you and to really take time to say, this is what I like, this is what I didn't like. And I feel like so much of that now is it hasn't been as helpful as it's been in the past. Did you feel like throughout this entirety of growing as a play-by-play broadcaster that you got enough feedback?
I don't think anybody ever feels like they get enough feedback. I mean, I would say that's probably the one request that most of us have more than anything else. But at the same time, and if you think about it, our business is very unique in this way. 99% of the time, the people that are tasked with giving you feedback, and they're the same people that are doing the hiring and the firing and are making the decisions who they think is good, who they think isn't so good, who should be on the biggest games, who shouldn't be on the biggest games, what assignments you get, so on and so forth. 99% of the time, those people are people who have never worn a headset mm-hmm. and never will wear a headset, have never called a game, and never will call a game. So it really is a very subjective business in that way. I mean, really, sometimes what makes their opinion any better or worse than the guy at the end of the bar watching the game on TV going, you know what, I like that guy. I think he calls a good game. Or, I'm not a big fan of that guy. He's not my cup of tea. You know, I don't know. Now, if you spend your whole life in professional television, even if you're not a broadcaster, you're doing that because you've got a talent. So certainly the executives that run our business are people that have achieved the level of success they've achieved for a reason. I mean, they have produced highly rated shows, and they are people that have risen up the chain because they've made good decisions, and those decisions have borne out in good hirings and, you know, acquiring properties for networks. And, you know, I mean, they've earned the right to make the decisions that they make, but it's still very unusual that none of them have the actual practical experience to say, I can put myself in that guy's shoes. I can imagine what it was like to wear a headset at that moment. And here's why he did what he did or didn't do what he didn't do, and give feedback from a position of knowledge. They just don't have it. So I'm wondering if sometimes that doesn't hold back some of that feedback, because the people that are tasked with giving it, and that sometimes you're looking for it from them, are people that are never going to do your job. And are never going to really know what it is to do your job.
No, I think that's really interesting, especially because you're getting it from so many different points of view. And also when you're calling a game, like you talked about earlier, you're trying to make it conversational. You're trying to get out of the way and let the action speak for itself. So there might be people that say, I want you to be more of a part of it. And some others might have the complete opposite response. I want to go back a little bit because you're a BC grad. I think you graduated, what, 1993?
93 is correct.
So were you there at the same time as Joe Tessitore and Boog Shambi? And I think that's so cool that if you guys were all there around the same time working over at WZBC, now all of you guys are at ESPN together. That must have been a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, we did student radio together, all of us.
Were you guys doing shows or play-by-play together? Or how were those broadcasts like?
Yeah, all of that. I mean, there was actually, I remember vividly, one road trip where the only team that we would go on the road with was the football team as the student radio station. There was just no budget to go on the road with the hockey and basketball teams. But with the football team, we would go on the road. And when we went on the road, you know, it was just a student-run show. We would bring our case with our equipment in it and get some phone lines hooked up in the press box. And our senior year, the Shambi stayed until January of our senior year. So the fall of our senior year, BC played at West Virginia, and the broadcast team was me and those two knuckleheads. And so somewhere out there, I'm wondering, in the archives of, I guess, the student radio station, if there's a tape floating around of a BC-West Virginia football game from the fall of 1992 where we're the three people calling it. And I forget who did the pre- and post-game show and halftime and which one of us was play-by-play and which one of us was the analyst. I don't even remember what, you know, I mean, normally you kind of break the jobs up that way. I have no idea what each of us did. I just remember the three of us were there. And so, yeah, that would be a funny tape to listen to, come to think of it.
That'd be a lot of fun,
but
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was, we kind of had a miniature version of what you always hear, you know, is what you get at Syracuse. I mean, Syracuse is kind of the, you know, the Harvard Law School of what we do. It's, you know, it's that seems to be the finishing school. That's the gold standard. And part of the reason I think it has become that is because so many guys go there that have talent, that there's a tremendous level of competition to get better at it and prove that you can do it and sharpen your skills and study it and be educated about it and know what you're talking about and do your research and all of that, because you know if you don't, you're going to get exposed working next to guys who know what they're doing. Well, when I was at BC, and I had no idea this was going to be the case, when I got there as a freshman, I walked in like day two of my freshman year to the radio station and said to, you know, like the DJ with like pink and blue hair, hey, do they do sports here? And they were like, yeah, there's some guys that do sports here. You should definitely, you know, go see so-and-so. And I did. And, you know, a week later, I was there, you know, at the student-run talk show and met some of those guys. So, I mean, just kind of fortune smiled upon me that there were guys that also had that talent that just happened to be going to the college I was going to, having had no idea that they were going to pick DC as well. And doing student radio with those guys, there was definitely a level of competition where you were driven to try to get good at it, because you were working with guys that even in college you were saying, boy, these guys they're already pretty good at this. And so, yeah, I'm assuming, you know, I mean, it's the butterfly effect. You have no idea kind of the road less traveled. If we had all gone to different schools where our careers would have gone, maybe all of us would, you know, at this point still have successful broadcasting careers. But I definitely think that where we have all gotten to has a lot to do with having gone to school and worked together there and not even realizing it at the time. But I think there was a drive, a motivation, you know, a level of competition amongst us to try to get good at it and to be good at it, because the guys you were with were good at it.
Did you anticipate going into play-by-play right away? Because you kind of went maybe a little bit more of an untraditional route into play-by-play, because you spent some time in Miami as a talk show host and update anchor, and also spent some time at WFAN in New York. And I think it was once you got back to New York, that's when the opportunity at Comcast started to start doing more play-by-play. But could you have seen yourself as an on-air personality purely if the play-by-play opportunities never came along?
When I was in college, if you asked me what I wanted to do, my career goal would have been to be like Mike and the Mad Dog, to be a five-day-a-week, yelling and screaming at callers, talk show host, and I thought that was the greatest job in the world. What could be more fun than going to games, watching games on TV, and then going on the air and spouting your opinion about those games? And I still do that from time to time, because I do miss doing it. And I'm wondering if down the road in my career I might get back into that more. I would like to, because I'm full of opinions. I got a million things. Twitter has become almost like a little release valve, because you get to, like, you know, when you have a strong opinion, at least spout it out in some way, shape, or form. If there isn't a microphone in front of you, now everybody's got a keyboard right at their fingertips. So that's been good. I've been at least kind of able to spit it out. When I was in college, I mean, my first dozen or so years professionally working in this business were as a talk show host. I really, the play-by-play part of it was when, like you mentioned, doing some, you know, local Comcast Ivy League football games, I became the Jets pre- and post-game host, so that gave me an opportunity to be the fill-in guy on the Jets and do a few games there, and I kind of caught the bug a little bit where that is concerned. You do start to realize that it's a lot of fun to be at the game. You know, it's a lot of fun to be on before and after the game. But instead of waiting back in a studio for a game to end, it really is a lot of fun to be at the game and almost feel like you're a part of the game. So I was definitely drawn more to play-by-play, and you start to realize, you know, the whole reason we got into all this crazy, you know, traveling and business in the first place is because we love the games. You like being at the games. So I did morph more into play-by-play as my career went on because of that reason. But I absolutely, when I first began, you know, I was a junior in high school when WFAN came on the air. And I remember thinking, oh, man, like that sounds like the most fun place in the world to go work. And to eventually realize that dream and work there and have that kind of be the real jumping off point for my career, it really interesting in that way. But I was a talk show host for the first dozen or so years that I worked out of college.
It's interesting to watch how sort of that industry too, that sort of Mike and the Mad Dog was this sort of original creation. You've seen spawns off of Mike and the Mad Dog till a whole different generation of talk radio. And I think it's great that you're not only just doing play-by-play, but you're also filling in on 98.7, filling in on ESPN Radio and doing these shows. And I think your perspective on sort of having it from both sides, I think could be really unique. Have you thought about any like potential segments that you'd want to do? Like anything that's sort of been floating around in your head that says, all right, when I'm back on the air doing this type of show, this is what I want to do.
No, I mean, you know, like I'll be watching a game and, you know, like that call in the NFC Championship game last night, you want to have a microphone in front of you the next day to scream and yell about it. I have no idea why. It's probably a character flaw that drives us all into this crazy business in the first place. Like, why is it that I'm now seething about that call?
Right.
Or, you know, I can't believe that the Rams offensive line, you know, did so many different things against the Saints than they did against the Cowboys. And like, why those things bother me, I have no idea. But it's inside of you or not. And for whatever reason, it's inside of me to care about this stuff. And so
maybe can I interject for a second? I wonder if it's because sure. So much of your play by play style is you want it to be about the game versus having this sort of talk show format. You're spending so much of the broadcast calling the action that's happening, not necessarily giving an opinionated version of what you see. You know, that allows you to sort of scratch that other itch, telling and truly discussing how you feel.
No question, because when you're doing a game, I'm calling what is occurring in the game, but really, if you're going to, you know, if you're thinking about kind of the definition of the roles on the game, the guy I'm working with is the one that's supposed to have the opinion. I mean, I'm working with a coach, or I'm working with a player. I'm working with a guy that's, you know, been in the competition, that has studied his whole life. Like, if I'm working a football game with Brock Heward, he's supposed to have the opinion first. I mean, you know, the guy played in the NFL. He knows what he's talking about. I didn't play in the NFL. But there are times where I'm working with folks where I can tell my opinion is stronger than their opinion about what I'm seeing and what I'm calling. So to be a talk show host and to be able to go in, say, on a Monday after a football Sunday and have some, you know, four or five of those really juicy football topics to talk about from the day before, it's a great release. I mean, it's an awesome thing to be able – I really enjoy it because – it does kind of allow me to scratch that itch that I don't get to scratch at all, or at least barely scratch, when I'm doing a game. Because if I start spouting my opinion out about the game I'm doing, and I'm doing play-by-play, well, now, A, my analyst, not only am I stealing all of his thunder, but he won't even have time to get a word in because I'll be the only one talking. So, I mean, I do understand as a play-by-play guy that there is a defined role there. And sometimes you can branch out. I mean, I'll offer my opinion. A lot of times I'll play devil's advocate to what my analyst is talking about.
Sure.
And a lot of the analysts that I've really enjoyed working with are the ones that have taken the time to understand that I do know what I'm talking about, and I'm going to put the time in. All the football guys that I've worked with, I mean, I've watched hours upon hours upon hours of film with a lot of them for that very reason, because I want to know what they think is important about the game we're going to call. And I also want them to know that I observe things. And I may have an opinion about something that I observe that might spark an opinion out of them, that might begin a discussion, that might take the game to a place that they didn't even expect that it would go. And sometimes that's fun. So, but even with that being said, that's probably about 10% of my role. 90% of my role is calling the game, being that traffic cop, hopefully just supplementing what you're seeing on the screen, and also asking my analysts some questions to put them in the best possible spot to show what they can do.
So how much preparation do you have, not just for the game itself, but for the analysts that you'll be sitting alongside with? Like, I would imagine it's very different calling a game with Fran Fischilla than it is with Dick Vitale.
Yeah, but you obviously want to know who you're working with, what they're best at, and what they're most passionate about. You know, Fran is a true tactician. He's a coach at heart with a dry erase board in his brain, and he is watching the game from kind of an analytical standpoint. And Dick is obviously a lot more just getting wrapped up in the enthusiasm of the crowd and the atmosphere and the fans, and isn't this great? And, you know, and I mean, you want – when I'm working with Dick, it really is about making sure that he can do his Dick Vitale thing, because he's – amazing. And it's so much fun sitting right next to him when he's doing it. His enthusiasm at 79 and a half years old is ridiculous. You know, so, but with Fran, it is a little different. Like, I probably will ask Fran a few more questions during the game than I will Vitale. Vitale's going to do his thing, and it's awesome. But I think Fran is looking for someone to challenge him a little bit at times about, you know, setting him up to show you what you can't see. You know, Brock Heward, same way. If I'm doing a football game with him, he wants questions to be fired at him. You know, ask me about something that you notice, because if I notice it and I'm wondering about it, it's probably a pretty good chance a lot of the other amateurs that are home, you know, watching the game or maybe thinking about the same thing. You know, so I think my job is to know who I'm working with, what they're best at, what they're most comfortable and most enthusiastic about wanting to point out in the game we're doing, and then doing what I can do as a facilitator to bring that out of them while we're calling the game together. And if I'm doing that, if at the end of the game, they're able to say, you know, this was good. I really got a chance to attack the broadcast tonight to my strengths in the way that I do it. Hopefully if they're riding home and that's what they're thinking, then beyond just calling the game and hopefully supplementing it from that standpoint, I did my job.
I could talk to you for hours about this, and I know you got limited time, so I only got a few more for you. I saw a funny tweet. It was either late last night or early this morning, where you talked about how you had tanked an audition for the XFL. So I'd love to hear the backstory behind that, and how does one tank a broadcast audition?
I tanked the audition by calling a game the way that I would call a game right down the middle, knowing that that's not what they were looking for. I mean, I guess to give background to it, like, I was the Jets pre- and post-game host, certainly had aspirations to at some point become an NFL broadcaster, if not on radio, certainly on television. And it was pretty obvious back then that if you became a voice of the XFL, you might be blackballed from the NFL forever. But having said that, I'm like 26, 27 years old. I haven't done any network work at that point. And someone from NBC working in New York, kind of tasked with finding young talent, calls me up and says, do you want to audition? And so what do you say as a 26-year-old to an NBC executive? Now, I'm going to skip your network level audition because really it's beneath me. And he's going to be thinking, what, you're doing updates on like the local sports radio station. Do you understand the opportunity that I'm giving you? So now you're trying not to offend the person that is asking you to come audition, and understand it's flattering in and of itself.
Sure.
That someone at the network level would want you to audition for anything, but also understanding that if I actually got the job, probably a bad thing for me long term. So how do you not get the job intentionally, but also, you know, not anger the person or offend the person that asked you to come audition for it in the first place? So I knew what they were looking for. I mean, it was Vince McMahon. It was the WWF. It was the XFL. So I knew what they wanted. Well, I got into a broom closet studio and called the football game the way I would if it was Jets Colts on a Sunday afternoon. I called it straight. I did the best football call I could do. knowing that afterwards they were going to say, yeah, you're not really what we're looking for. And that's exactly what happened. You know, I just kind of, you know. So it's not like I went in and, you know, purposely misidentified players or something stupid like that. I mean, I did what I think was a confident football call. But just knowing that a straight down the middle call of a football game, the way you would expect to hear if it's Bengals Chargers on a Sunday afternoon, was not what they were looking for. But I didn't want to be what they were looking for, because it just, I didn't think long term for my career that was going to be something that, you know, even in short term for my career, that was going to be something that was going to be smiled upon, certainly by the people I was working for at the Jets.
There's so much tactical information that came into still giving a quality broadcast.
I'm glad. Yeah. I mean, you know, it really is the truth. Like, I went in knowing if I call this right down the middle, I'm not getting the job.
Right.
So call it right down the middle. They can't be mad at you, because you're really, all you did was you went in and you were you. That was what I did. I was myself. You know, I mean, I wasn't Mean Gene Okerlund. Like,
no.
I wasn't going to go in and do like a Bobby the Brain Heenan call of football. I was going to do what I do. And I knew that wasn't going to be what they were looking for, and I figured long-term that was probably the best thing.
I've also had you on my other podcast, the Fantasy Sports Markets podcast, with several other broadcasters and writers and talk show hosts, and this was when we all got together on a Wednesday evening for a Fish song draft. And, you know, I was a bit of a late bloomer into the world of Fish. I didn't see my first show. I'm 30 now, but I didn't see my first show until 2011 over at Meriwether Post Pavilion. In Columbia, Maryland. That was when I was working in D.C. What was your first show, and do you remember what ultimately tied you to this world of Fish that we both truly love?
Well, it was a bunch of my closest friends, even to this day. I mean, people that I spent New Year's Eve with at the Garden this year, who introduced me to Fish. This is going back to 94, I want to say, somewhere in that range, 93, like right after I got out of college. I got a job in Miami, and I would come home on like winter break and, you know, summertime, visit some of my friends. They all rented a house together. And I remember all the way back then, I'm 23, 24 years old, somebody pulls out a cassette tape, and it's like a Fish bootleg concert from, you know, like a bar in Vermont or something, where, you know, I mean, those guys have always, you know, before we got into the digital world, they used to have a tapers section where you would get a tapers ticket to a Fish show, where if you got a tapers ticket, that meant you were in a specific section where they told you you're fine to bring your shotgun microphone and a tape recorder, tape our show and give it to whoever you want to give it to. Like, not only are we not going to be angry about you bootlegging our show, we encourage it. And so some of my friends had bootleg copies of Fish shows from, you know, all the way back in like the early 90s, when they were a little more than a college band. And it was amazing. And honestly, it was 2 years later, they were selling out Madison Square Garden for New Year's Eve. And I remember going, I think it was 97 into 98. So it was the New Year's Eve show in 1998 was the first time that I ever saw them live. It was the first time I ever went to a show. So, and I think the second time I went to a show was New Year's Eve 1999 at the Garden. It even took me a little while of going to some of those shows to really get it and fall in love with it. But yeah, I mean, it's been something that a bunch of friends that I've had from the time I was in college to this day, and my wife likes it more than I do. So it's a great thing for us to do together. And yeah, that's really kind of where it all started.
That's awesome. Now you have a fantastic New Year's Eve date every year over at the Garden right in your backyard. And by the way, for those that are interested in trying to wonder what Bob chose in the Fish song draft, I have it right in front of me. With the number 3 overall pick, he was able to get You Enjoy Myself. After Tweezer and Lushington were taken number 1 and number 2 overall, he rounded out his draft with Harry Hood, Run Like an Antelope, and Golgi Apparatus. So you know the picks were solid, and I think from a lot of the votes, people had you in the top 3 amongst all of us.
That draft was one of the proudest nights I was ever able to be a part of, a group of really nerdy guys. Like, I just embraced the nerddom of that because, you know, I am a total nerd when it comes to stuff like that. And you know, that was a lot of fun.
We'll do it again. Hopefully we can have an even bigger cast of characters next time around and expand it a little bit. But regardless, I appreciated you then. I appreciate your time now. This is a lot of fun. And good luck with the calls the rest of the season. And looking forward to talking again soon, Bob.
Thanks a million, Ben. I appreciate it.